strong, strategic moves that will help you land at retirement in solid shape. Wait until you are 60 or 65 to see where you are, and you leave yourself little time or room to adjust. Step 1. Get an estimate of your annual income in retirement. How much you have saved up is not a very helpful number. What you really want to know is how much annual income that number can generate for you in retirement without running out too fast. The trick with your retirement funds is that you don't want to withdraw too much in the early years of retirement and then run the risk of not having money to support an extra long life. The good news is that it's now a fairly easy task to figure out how much monthly or annual retirement income you are on pace to have. Your workplace plan, or the company where you have your IRAs, should have a free online calculator that will give you a personalized retirement income estimate based on your savings, estimated Social Security benefit, and other income sources. Or you can use the free online AARP retirement calculator. I hope what you find out is that you are on track. But if the estimate of your monthly retirement income came up short of what you had hoped, please don't panic. We still have 15 to 20 years to get you in even better shape to enjoy the retirement you deserve. Please focus on what is possible from this day forward. Now might be a good time to circle back to what I asked you to embrace at the beginning of this retirement section. Fear comes from inaction. I am ready to remove worry and anxiety from my today's by making smart and strong decisions that will build retirement security. One option at this juncture is to increase what you are contributing to your retirement plans. Remember, once you are 50, the annual contribution limits are higher for 401ks and IRAs. In 2018, you can save as much as $24,500 in a 401k and $6,500 in an IRA. There is so much you can achieve in the next 15 years or more. I offer you this moment of savings motivation. The 15-year sprint to the finish. Saving $100 more a month can increase your savings by $27,000. Saving $400 more a month can increase your savings by $107,000. Saving $1,000 more a month can increase your savings by $267,000. This is assuming a 5% annualized rate of return. There is one caveat to consider. If you are determined to stay in your home when you retire and will not have the mortgage paid off, I explain in step 2 that you may want to consider paying off your mortgage rather than turbo saving more in your retirement plans. Can't imagine how to save another penny more? On to the next step. Save more by spending less. It is the rare household that has no give in its budget to squeeze out more money for retirement savings. It is also the rare household that thinks this is true. For decades, I have counseled individuals and families who come to me with a shortfall problem. They can't pay their credit card off each month. There's not enough to build an emergency fund. There's no way they can afford the premium for term life insurance. They want to take control of their financial life, but they tell me they just don't make enough money. That's usually not the entire problem. Lifestyle creep is a part of their problem. Even for people who understand the difference between needs and wants, the needs end up being way too expensive. Yes, you need a car, but you could have bought a much less expensive one. Yes, the kids need clothes, but they do not need the pricey jeans they ask for, yet you can't seem to say no to. This sort of lifestyle creep can build up over time. You struggled as a 20-something, but as your career and income grew over the past few decades, so too have your spending habits. If the retirement income estimate you got in step one wasn't what you had hoped for, scaling back on spending today is how you can help your future self. Not just by freeing up some money that can be saved in retirement accounts. One of the most overlooked benefits of cinching in your spending a notch or two today is that you are also recalibrating your future retirement income needs. Living on less today means needing to generate less income in retirement to maintain that lifestyle. Nip and tuck. Let's start with the low-hanging fruit in your monthly spending. I am a big fan of finding small spending trims that, when added together, can add up to $100 or $200 more a month in savings. That is then $100 or $200 more you can devote to retirement savings. Drop down a tier on the cable and cell phone plan. Extend the number of weeks between cuts and mani-pedis. Stay in one more Saturday night a month. I bet you can find $1,000 in savings a year that can be redirected into retirement savings. Probably more. Yep, those are all lifestyle choices I am asking you to consider trimming. If you insist on being a glass half-empty type person, you are likely feeling dejected right now that I am asking you to rein in your lifestyle. Once again, I ask you to open your head and heart to an alternative interpretation. It's not about going without less today. You are giving yourself more for your tomorrows. How is that not empowering? How is that not a reasonable trade-off to consider? Women and Money readers can access my online expense tracker for free. It's a great tool for helping you recognize where you can trim spending so you can save more. Go to SusieOrman.com/women and use the activation code WOMEN. Cars and college, your source of retirement security. As I explained in the Spend Smart section of the Financial Empowerment Plan, there is a tremendous amount of future security that can be wrung out from not overspending today on big-ticket items. If you happen to glide past that part of the FEP, please circle back. Taking that advice to heart is how you can unearth big sums of future retirement security. For instance, drive the cars you have longer. Every month you keep a car after paying off the loan is a month where you have more money to put toward retirement. And when you do need to buy a new car, buy the cheapest car possible. Your car strategy can generate $200 or more a month in savings for long stretches that can be redirected into your retirement accounts. And those of you with children who will be college-bound in the next 15 years, you must open your heart and head to the advice I shared in the previous section. As counterintuitive as it may seem, as emotionally challenging as I know it is, focusing on saving for your retirement rather than paying for college is the most loving step you can take. It will help you remain independent as you age, rather than needing your adult children to step in with financial aid for your retirement. That's the gift for your adult kids. And in the here and now, if you follow my college spending advice, they can still have a great education that is affordable. Step 2. Home in on retirement security. Most 50-somethings these days report that they intend to stay in their home rather than downsize or move to a less expensive neighborhood or region. Or the tendency is not to think about it at all right now. You'll wait to see how you feel at 65 and make some decisions then. I am asking you to do some serious thinking right now. The questions you should be asking yourself today. If you intend to move between now and retirement, would moving sooner than later free up sizable savings? I know this is a big ask. It's your home, not your car, I am suggesting you sell. But if you take the time to step through the payoff, I think you may find it easier to make your move today. The financial weight that can be lifted can make all the difference today and in retirement. If you are currently paying a mortgage, could you sell your home and buy another home mortgage-free? Or if your intention is to rent, how much lower could your monthly rent be compared to the mortgage, property tax, and maintenance costs you have as a homeowner? Take your current monthly housing costs and subtract an estimate of your downsized monthly housing costs. That's your estimated monthly savings. What could that monthly savings buy you? Maybe more money to save in your 401k or IRA. Maybe the money to have a wonderful restorative vacation each year that you pay off in full. Far from an indulgence, recharging your batteries is how you can help yourself work longer. A popular retirement strategy we will discuss in the next step, rather than burn out earlier. If you intend to stay put, have you honestly run the numbers to make sure you can afford the property tax and maintenance? Now that you have the monthly retirement income estimate from step one, will there be enough to easily handle these fixed costs? If it's a stretch today, it's likely going to be a challenge in retirement. Will your home be comfortable for an older you? The home that worked so well to raise your family, the home that is full of memories, is not necessarily the perfect home in retirement. How many stairs are there to navigate into the home, up to the bedroom? Is there a bathroom near the master bedroom where the door opening is wide enough to accommodate a walker? Is the laundry inconveniently located in the basement? I understand those questions may make you feel a bit uneasy, but that's nothing compared to how uncomfortable you will be in retirement if you find yourself stuck in a home that isn't kind to an older you. Many near retirees are tackling renovation projects today to make their home more hospitable for their retirement years, building a master suite on the first floor, revamping the bathroom to have the space to maneuver with a walker, and maybe installing a walk-in shower. If you want to remodel your home for your retirement years, I am again going to ask you to spend smart. Can you honestly afford the renovations? If you intend to use a home equity line of credit or home equity loan to pay for the work, your borrowing should be limited to what you can afford to pay back within 5 to 7 years, or before you retire, whichever comes sooner. Will you have the mortgage paid off before you retire? I am concerned that the answer many of you just gave was no. The percentage of homeowners at least 65 years old who still had a mortgage climbed from 22% in 2001 to 30% in 2013, and I have every reason to expect the trend to continue. Many of you bought a new home between 2000 and 2007 and refinanced during the past decade when rates were so low. That could leave you with 20 or more years of mortgage payments. If your intention is to stay in the home when you retire, and you are confident you can afford to pay the ongoing taxes and maintenance costs, you must make it a goal to pay off the mortgage before you retire. There is no greater pressure release valve than to be rid of a mortgage payment when you begin living off of your retirement income. While today's younger adults have the chance to do all of their retirement saving in Roth accounts, it's likely that much, if not all, of your retirement savings is in traditional 401ks and IRAs. And that can create a bigger hurdle in retirement if you intend to still have a mortgage. Remember, every dollar you withdraw from a traditional retirement account will be taxed as ordinary income. So let's say you have a $1,500 a month mortgage payment. That's $18,000 a year you need to pay the mortgage. that's going to require withdrawing a lot more than $18,000. You would need to withdraw around $25,000 a year to be left with the $18,000 you need after paying your federal and state, where applicable, tax. That can put a lot of pressure on your retirement savings. Not only do you not want to deplete your savings too fast in retirement, but also, the larger your withdrawals, the bigger the tax bill you may face, because all of your withdrawals will be counted as taxable income. Moreover, the amount your Social Security benefit is subject to income tax, as well as your Medicare Part B and prescription drug coverage premiums, is based on how much taxable income you have. The higher your income, the more those benefits can cost you. Now that you understand why I am so eager for you to pay off your mortgage before you retire, assuming it is your forever home, here's how you do it. Contact your lender or loan servicer and ask for an updated amortization schedule that will have your mortgage paid off by the time you are 65. Even if you intend to keep working past age 65, I still want you to aim to be mortgage-free by 65. You can't control your health. Working longer may not be practical, or you may find yourself pushed out of a job sooner than anticipated. Consider saving less in your retirement accounts so you can get the mortgage paid off. Yes, you heard that correctly. I am telling you to save less if it frees up the cash you need to get the mortgage paid off before you retire. Ideally, you can ramp up your mortgage payments today by tightening your spending a bit to find the extra cash. But if that's not going to do the trick, you can temporarily ratchet down your retirement savings contributions. If you have a workplace retirement plan that offers a matching contribution, you must continue to contribute enough to earn the maximum matching contribution from your employer. There is never any circumstance where I would advise you to pass up that match. But beyond that base savings, I have no problem if you reduce your contributions if it helps you find the cash to get your mortgage paid off before you retire. Step 3. Work on a working longer plan. Working longer can indeed be a great tool for building retirement security. Not only does it give you more time to potentially save more, it reduces the number of years you will live off of your retirement savings. I am a big believer that everyone should consider 70 the new normal retirement age. If you can afford to retire sooner, that's great. But I think planning to age 70 is practical and responsible. With the likelihood you could live into your 90s, retiring at 62 or 65 puts too much pressure on many retirement savings accounts. That's a lot of years to support yourself. But having the intention to delay the date you retire can be an extremely dangerous strategy if you don't carefully plan. I am all for your 50-something selves having the intention today that you will keep working until age 70. But intentions aren't guarantees. Many people who expected to keep working into their late 60s find themselves retiring sooner than expected due to a personal illness, due to caring for someone with an illness, due to burnout, due to being pushed out ever so deftly by management that is careful not to make it about your age. As if. This is where you need to plan, not just hope. Stay cutting edge at work. The skills that got you to your current status as a respected 50-something employee or business owner will not necessarily sustain you for another 15 or 20 years. You must commit yourself to having every skill that a 25-year-old new hire brings to the table. Yet what I see happen so often is that older workers don't keep current. They invest all their energy into hoping they will somehow be able to have an extended run. That might work when the economy is humming, But you better realize that at the first whiff of an economic slowdown, employers will start the cost cutting. Employees with outdated skills will be the first targets. If you are lucky enough to have on-the-job continuing ed, you are nuts if you don't reserve a seat at every session or devour every online offering. And take a hard look at where the business seems to be headed. Are there new skills and jobs that are in demand? Talk to your manager and HR about the skills they are hungry to see over the next few years. Then get to work on making yourself a valued employee for the future by going back to school. There are plenty of free and affordable online courses, or check out the curriculum at local community colleges. Plan a smooth segue to a post-career job. The reality is that you may not need or want to stay in your current career job throughout your 60s, or it may not be practical. Look around your current office. How many 60-somethings are there? Downshifting to a less demanding, lower-paying job can be all that is needed in your 60s. You can give your retirement plan a big shot in the arm simply by not tapping your savings in your 60s or not taking a reduced Social Security benefit in your early 60s. More on this in the next step. And all you need to pull that off is to make enough money to pay your living costs. If you can't keep contributing to your retirement savings, that's okay. You are still helping yourself plenty by making enough money so you can delay touching any of your retirement savings for a few more years. Maybe you cover your living expenses by taking on consulting work or projects, or maybe it's your chance to follow a less lucrative passion, whether it is a hobby you want to earn some income from, or maybe giving back by teaching or coaching. The point is, you need to plan for your 60s work life. Will you need to take some courses to get a certification? Or maybe you need to double down now on networking and starting to consult on projects. That will be a lot better than trying to make the shift cold turkey once you leave your career job. Step 4. Plan for your 90-year-old self. 95 is even better. Once you turn 65, I have news for you. You need to appreciate how young you really are. Quick quiz. If you are 65 in 2018 and in average health and you aren't a smoker, what are the odds that you may still be alive at age 90? A, 17%. B, 31%. C, 46%. Answer, C. There's a near 50% chance you will still be alive at age 90. That's not exactly an outlier possibility. A 65-year-old woman in excellent health has a 54% probability of still being alive at age 90. I hope that delivers some valuable perspective. Please don't fall into the trap of thinking the day you retire is some sort of end date or a countdown of sorts. Your 65-year-old self could be very alive for another 30 years. She's got a lot of living left to do, and that requires some careful planning. Keep investing for some growth. You may stop working full-time at 65 or 70, but don't assume your money can stop working hard. You certainly want to invest more conservatively than you did in your 30s and 40s, but that doesn't mean all your money belongs in cash or bonds. One of the big challenges in retirement is to invest in a way that keeps your portfolio rising over time at a rate that is at least in line with the annual increase in living costs. Your grocery bill, healthcare costs and housing expenses 20 and 30 years from now will be more than today. The rising cost of goods and services is called inflation. The long-term annual inflation rate is around 3%, so you want your investments to earn at least that much. As I write this, K cash accounts earn just 1% or so. And most high-quality bonds have yields, interest payments, of less than 3%. Keeping a portion of your investments in stocks gives you the ability to earn higher inflation-beating returns over the long term. How much? Well, a pretty good rule of thumb is to subtract your age from 100, or 110 if you want your plan to assume you will live to 95. The result is how much you might want to keep in stocks. A 65-year-old might have 35% invested in stocks. A 70-year-old, 30%. Get the biggest check possible from Social Security. Once you turn 62, you have a great opportunity to boost your retirement income with one simple but often hard decision. Do not begin your Social Security retirement payments. Yes, age 62 is when you are allowed to take Social Security retirement benefits. But if you start at 62, you will be accepting a lower payment than if you wait. There are three key claiming milestones. Age 62. You are eligible to start taking your retirement benefit. Claim at age 62, and your benefit will be up to 30% less than if you wait 4 or 5 more years. Normal retirement age. This is the year when you are entitled to 100% of your earned benefit. Your normal retirement age, also called full retirement age, is somewhere between 66 and 67, based on the year you were born. Age 70. This is the starting age that will qualify you for the largest possible benefit. For someone with a normal retirement age of 67, waiting until age 70 will entitle you to a monthly payment that is 24% higher than if you started at age 67. There is no investment in the world that can deliver a guaranteed 24% gain over 3 years. Might you die before age 70, or before you collect enough payments to break even? Yep. Yet that's so not the point. Anyone who makes those arguments isn't focused on what really matters. Providing security for the possibility you will still be very much alive through your 80s and into your 90s. Delaying until age 70 essentially buys you more retirement income for your later life. While you may ponder the prospect of dying, I am focusing on how very long you may live and giving you a way to have the highest possible income in your 80s and 90s. Please consider delaying taking Social Security until you are 70. You can tap your other retirement income sources, such as your 401k and IRAs, while still letting your Social Security benefit grow to age 70. Social Security for married couples. Ladies, please listen to this very carefully. Widows are entitled to one Social Security benefit. When a spouse dies, the survivor can choose to keep her benefit or switch over to the benefit of her deceased spouse. You don't get to collect both, just one. The smartest move, the crucial move I strongly encourage every married couple to consider, is that the spouse with the highest earnings delay starting Social Security until age 70. That's how you can ensure that whoever is the surviving spouse will be able to collect the highest possible benefit. It does not matter who is older. All that you need to focus on is having the spouse who's the higher earner delay. If the other spouse wants to start collecting before age 70, that's okay, though that partner should please try and wait until normal retirement age. You can get an estimate of your expected Social Security benefit at different claiming ages at the Social Security website, ssa.gov. Search for Social Security Estimator. Consider long-term care insurance. Anyone already in her 50s, doesn't need to be told that getting old can be a health challenge that carries a great financial burden. Whether you yourself have helped your parents navigate older age, or you've been the shoulder a friend leaned on as she cared for elderly relatives, you likely understand what's at stake. One of the most profound and liberating steps you can take when you hit 50 is to buy yourself some financial insurance to help if you become unable to fully navigate your day-to-day life on your own. Long-term care insurance, LTCI, can provide the money to hire someone to help you with these activities or to pay for care in an assisted living facility or nursing home. The fact that women live longer than men increases the likelihood that we may at some point be widowed and unable to care for ourselves. A sobering reality of aging is that one day we may no longer be the wonder women we once were, caring for our parents, our children, our husbands, our friends. One day, we may not even be able to care for ourselves. Whether it be at-home care or care in an assisted living facility, we may indeed need help. A few of us will need nursing home care. All of it is expensive. A health insurance policy will not cover this kind of care, nor will Medicare. So who will pay for long-term care if it's needed? You will, out of your own pocket. Caring for your latter life self is the biggest threat to your retirement savings. If you need lots of support, you run the risk of outliving your savings. When you have spent most of your money, Medicaid will pay, but you won't have as many choices. That's why I ask every woman to carefully consider long-term care insurance once she turns 50. An LTCI policy can provide the money to hire someone for additional help at home, or you can use LTCI to help pay for nursing home care if it is ever needed. Why my insistence on tackling this project when you are just 50 years young? Because if you decide LTCI makes sense for you and your household, it is smarter to buy it when you are younger and healthier than to try to obtain coverage a decade from now, when pre-existing conditions can make you ineligible or a policy too expensive. And to be very clear, if you are married or living with a life partner, I want you both to consider LTCI. There is no more physically and emotionally demanding job than being the primary caregiver to an ailing spouse. LTCI buying tips. Unfortunately, buying LTCI insurance is not as easy and straightforward as buying term life insurance. It is not exactly cheap. An annual premium can be anywhere from $2,000 to $3,000 or more. And insurers can get approval from state insurance commissioners to increase the premium costs for existing policyholders. When that happens, the increases can be 30% to 50% or more. Doesn't exactly sound like a great sales pitch, does it? I am in no way pleased that, to date, the industry has done a lousy job of figuring out how to correctly price these policies. That said, it is likely that these growing pains, for what is a relatively new type of insurance, will not continue at the same pace for anyone buying a policy today. The LTCI industry is now using better assumptions that should reduce the need for major premium hikes going forward. And I think that even with the premium challenge, LTCI is still very much worth considering. Just take a step back and focus on the bigger picture. If you ever need care, your premiums will be a small fraction of the benefits you can tap. I am recommending that you carefully think through whether a plan makes sense for your household. The AARP has a solid primer on LTCI considerations. Search for AARP Understanding Long-Term Care Insurance. And I have learned so much from LTCI expert Phyllis Shelton whose consumer website, GOTLTCI.com, is a good place to start your learning. Among the key factors I want you to consider, buy a policy you could still afford if the premium doubled. I don't want you to ever feel a policy has become so expensive that you let it lapse. That's such a tragic waste of all the years of premiums you paid. It is far better to buy a scaled-back policy today that you will still be able to afford if sometime in the future you are hit with premium increases. Involve the family. I respect that $2,000 to $3,000 or more a year is a lot of money. But it is an expense I bet your adult kids will be very eager to help you with. Don't give me the pride side eye. This is how you protect your kids. If they are able to chip in to help you afford a solid LTCI policy, you have just helped them out of a potentially huge crunch years from now. Without an LTCI policy, they may find it necessary to help pay for your care later on, or curtail their careers to step into the full-time caregiver role. Grab the inflation rider. One way insurance agents can lower the premium cost if there is sticker shock is to offer a policy that does not provide an inflation adjustment. I recommend you always purchase a policy with this insurance protection. I would rather you reduce other benefits, if necessary, such as purchasing a policy with a lower lifetime benefit, than forego this important protection against ever-rising care costs. Be kind to your future self with a healthier attitude today. Lifestyle choices you make today can play a role in how seamlessly you transition to retirement. I am not going to tell you how to exercise or what to eat, but I am going to cheerlead. Your body and your mind are your two most valuable assets. Invest in them, and the payoff can be enormous. You are bound to feel better today and potentially help yourself land in retirement in better shape and happier. Being able to enjoy your retirement strikes me as the ultimate goal of retirement planning. 4. Give to others. Family finances. You don't exist in this world alone. You are at the center of a web of relationships, and navigating them can be very complicated, especially when money is involved. The vast majority of women I meet have problems not with money per se, but with relationships. The money problem is usually a symptom or a consequence of the relationship problem. In previous chapters, we talked about how women equate giving with a show of love. So when we love a person or a cause so much, our nurturing soul directs us to give, give, give. We give money, even if it means digging into home equity lines of credit, ringing up more debt on credit cards, or co-signing loans. We say yes to whatever is asked of us, rather than stopping to assess the impact it will have on our lives emotionally and financially. We tend to let other people set the agenda for us. They tell us what they need, and we put their needs front and center, even if it means sweeping everything we need aside. We are more committed to helping others than we are to helping ourselves. Are you one of these women? The woman who knows deep down that an emergency savings account is the core of financial security. But when her sister falls behind on the mortgage, car, and credit card payment for the umpteenth time, she once again cleans out her only savings account because she can't imagine not helping. The wife who knows deep down that the equity she and her husband have in their home is an asset that should be saved and protected, not spent. But when her husband has his midlife crisis and announces that he wants to quit his job to pursue a startup business, she doesn't have the heart or courage to say no. The woman who knows deep down that her best friend is a financial train wreck, but still agrees to co-sign a car loan for her, which means, most likely, she will end up paying for that friend's car, even though she cannot afford to do so. The daughter who sends $500 a month to her parents to help them with their bills, even though that means she doesn't have the money to cover her own expenses. The stay-at-home mom who is in charge of the household shopping and bill paying, but can't make ends meet on what is in the bank account and assumes it is her fault. The bride-to-be who is too afraid to ask for a prenuptial agreement or talk about money before her wedding date because she thinks it will take the romance out of the relationship. The beloved employee who kicks in $25 every time she is asked to contribute to a coworker's wedding present, birthday party, or Christmas celebration, even though it puts her behind in paying her own bills. The mother who continues to bail out her adult children from their mistakes. What I find both moving and encouraging is that women who find themselves in these kinds of situations realize, on some level, that they are just as much the problem as those who are making the money demands on their life. Loving someone you are committed to does not mean that you always have to give money. It simply means you have to be able to give of yourself. And giving of yourself takes us right back to the 8 qualities of a wealthy woman. For it takes more power to say no out of love than to say yes out of weakness. I want you to consider this concept for another moment, because it's a big one, ladies. It takes more power to say no out of love than to say yes out of weakness. This notion is at the very heart of establishing a healthy relationship with your money. This section of the Financial Empowerment Plan is all about helping you learn how to engage with your family from a position of love. What I want more than anything is for you to experience the calm and confidence that comes when you know your choices are nurturing everyone. Everyone, including you. If you have listened this long, the notion of being generous to yourself should not be an uncomfortable jolt. You now know that putting yourself first is anything but selfish. It is the singular act that will enable you to care for and support your family in a manner that uplifts you all. It is only when you are strong and confident that you are in a position to give the very best of yourself to the relationships that mean everything to you. Be as committed to yourself as you are to others. As straightforward and logical as it may seem to talk to those you love from a place of power and honesty, in reality, it is probably one of the hardest things you will ever have to do. Saying no to someone you love is difficult. It is easier to make a mess of our finances by saying yes all the time than to live with the fear of what the word no will do to our relationships. But as every woman who has fallen into this habit will tell you in hindsight, making money decisions in the hope of saving a relationship always backfires. That is why we go right back to the mainstay of keeping you in a healthy relationship with your money. Are you doing what is easy, or are you doing what is right? Write it, read it, live it. I love my smartphone and all my tech, but I also still lean on some low-tech ways to motivate. The simple act of writing down an intention and putting it in plain sight, not buried in an app that I have to remember to open, can be incredibly helpful and powerful. Exercise. Get it right. Pull out a piece of paper. A post-it is great. And a pen. Write these words. From this moment on, when it comes to my money and my relationships, I promise always to do what is right rather than what is easy. Sign and date this intention. Place it where you will see it repeatedly. A bathroom mirror, your laptop case or the corner of your desktop, the car dashboard. Every time you see it, repeat the truth at least 3 times. My hope is that by constantly connecting to this thought, it becomes a guiding principle throughout your day. Before making any moves with money, your own money or money that you share with someone, I want you to ask yourself, am I doing this because it's the right thing to do or because it's easy? It's easy to tell your boyfriend you'll lend him money that you don't have. It's easy to give your kids money even if it comes from your emergency fund. It's easy to avoid the topic of a will or trust with your husband because he's afraid of his own mortality. But doing what is easy is not how you build a healthy relationship with people or with money. Establish a collaborative process for handling money decisions with your honey. It's so easy to hand over responsibility for financial matters to your partner. For those of you married to a man, history works in favor of that, as handling the money was always viewed as the man's domain. But it's the 21st century, my dear ladies. It's time to let go of that dynamic. I see far too many women of all sexual orientations lazily let their spouse or partner handle the money stuff because it mystifies them or doesn't interest them. Being in control of your financial destiny requires that you be an active participant, not just by paying bills, but in overseeing your investments too. Take this step, and I think you will be surprised how it will give you confidence that will radiate throughout your life and help your relationship. I have a funny story to tell you. When I decided to write this book, I began my research and sought out experts and professionals who specialized in working with women. After speaking to many of them, I decided it was time I stopped asking questions in general about women and started asking personal questions about how the women experts themselves handled their money. The answers I got startled me, to say the least. One brilliant academic admitted that her life partner handled their finances. She just didn't want to deal with them. She tried to read the statements, but none of it made any sense to her. Besides, she trusted him to take care of everything. So let me get this straight, I said. I have just been on the phone with you for over an hour, and you can tell me every hormonal, biochemical, and psychological reason why women behave in certain ways, yet you don't feel you have what it takes to understand money? Well, you can imagine that she got a compassionate earful from me. To repay the favor of the time she spent on the phone with me, I offered to review all her financial statements to make sure that her partner knew what he was doing with their money. The next morning, she sent me one statement after another, along with a note explaining that after our conversation, the professor couldn't stop thinking about what I had said to her about being in control of her own money. And that night, at her request, her partner walked her through every financial statement and explained everything to her. He was thrilled, finally, to have her involvement. And she was happy, too, because for the first time, she really understood what was going on in her financial life. Her partner had, in fact, done a great job with her money, so I called to tell her that. When she picked up the phone, she told me she felt like she had a healthier relationship with her money and her man. He actually loved and respected her more for taking this step. She also confessed that their sex had never been better. If only she'd known, she'd have gotten involved with her money sooner. See what I mean about people telling me everything? I also see women failing to step into the money conversation in new relationships. No matter if you are 22 and about to share a studio apartment, or 52, and about to share the beautiful home that you own outright, You must talk money before anyone moves anywhere. How will you split the rent or the mortgage payment? The grocery bill? What if he or she makes 3 times the amount you do? Depending on where you are in your relationship, here's how to make sure you and your honey are doing what is right, not just what is easy. When a newer relationship gets serious. In my perfect world, all couples would be open about their finances from the get-go. I am well aware this is not how it often plays out. Money is the last thing anyone wants to talk about. But you are absolutely nuts if you don't start talking and planning at the point you consider moving in together. The number one stressor in relationships is money. So often the problem is framed as arguments over not having enough money. I think that misses the real underlying missed opportunity. Having a united vision and plan for how you will handle money issues. You can have plenty of money, but if you and your partner are not in sync on how to spend, save, and share that money, your relationship is going to be severely stressed. You are not going to fall into that trap. Share your FICO credit scores. I have to tell you, this is the quickest and most revealing window into the financial makeup of your life partner-to-be. I know this isn't going to win me any romance awards, but I firmly believe that any person who is financially irresponsible is more likely to be emotionally irresponsible in a relationship. For that matter, if you are the one with a messy credit history, you owe it to your potential life partner to come clean. Now, if you or your life partner has a low FICO score, the relationship isn't doomed. I am in no way saying that a FICO score below 740 is the new relationship litmus test. The point is that you must both be honest and open about your financial situation. Ultimately, you should support each other in terms of stepping forward and fixing whatever financial mistakes you have made in the past. Lasting love and commitment is dependent on how we get through the messy stuff in life. But when the mess is so deep and ingrained, you also need to have the courage to exit a relationship. Not only because it will financially drain you, but because it is so emotionally costly. Sharing your FICO scores is an important conversation starter. Moving in together? Pre-plan how you will cover shared expenses. I know your biggest concern is how you will split the closet space, but what should really be at the top of your list is how you will split the bills. Too often, I hear of couples who move in together and then discover they had completely different assumptions about how they would share the finances. Assuming is not the way to go. Before anyone makes a move, make sure you agree on how the bills will be split. Do not automatically take for granted that 50-50 is the right answer. What if you make $100,000 and your partner makes $50,000? Is it fair to split everything 50-50? Split decision. A formula for determining who pays what. Add your monthly take-home pay to your partner's take-home pay. This gives you your total household income. Add up your shared monthly housing expenses. Divide your total monthly expenses by your combined take-home pay. This percentage is what you will each contribute to cover your shared expenses. Your monthly take-home pay multiplied by this percentage is your contribution to household expenses. Your partner's monthly take-home pay, multiplied by this percentage, is your partner's contribution to household expenses. An example. Let's say your after-tax pay is $7,000 a month, and your love brings home $3,000 a month. Your total household after-tax income is $10,000. Now add up all the expenses you have each month that keep the household running. Let's say those expenses for utilities, rent, phone, and so on come to $3,000 a month. Divide $3,000, your joint expenses, by $10,000, your joint take-home income, and that will give you 30%. That means that you each have to put up 30% of your take-home pay toward expenses, or $2,100 from you and $900 from your love. Equal percentages, not equal amounts. Set up a joint checking account to pay for household bills. Yes, keep your own checking account, but set up one together. I also highly recommend that you set up auto payment for your household expenses. This is a great testing ground for your money habits. 1 week before your appointed bill paying, both of you are to have deposited your share of the monthly expenses into that account. There are to be no slip-ups and no excuses. As far as I'm concerned, this is a litmus test to see how financially responsible your love interest is, and for your love interest to gauge the same about you. Before you marry. Given that women on average are marrying/partnering for the first time later in life, chances are that when you do find the right person, you may already have a lot of financial baggage in the form of assets and debts. And so too may your fiancé or life partner. The basic rule is that you are jointly entitled to assets accrued during a marriage, and you are both on the hook for debts accrued during the marriage. Anything you bring into the marriage is not automatically shared. Yet I have seen so many women run into trouble by switching titles or not clearly spelling out what is theirs and not ours. I've taken a strong position on this for a long time. I believe in prenuptial agreements. It has never been more important given the career success so many women bring into their relationships. If you are remarrying, this becomes even more important. I am not suggesting that either of you hoard what is yours, but with so much on the line, I want you to state clearly to each other what you expect to remain separately owned and what you expect to become shared assets or property. Fine-tune the money decisions in a long-term relationship. Many of you who have been married or partnered up for years may not have the healthiest financial relationship with your honey. For a number of you, the problem is that you have let your partner handle most of the decisions. At some point, you may have been so grateful that you didn't have to deal with it all. But now, not so much. You realize it has created an odd imbalance in your relationship. Or perhaps you have watched a friend or mother or sister struggle to get her financial bearings after a divorce or becoming widowed. Or maybe it's what you have learned while listening to this book that brings you to a new place. You want to be more involved with the money decisions. You are hungry for the emotional payoff that will come when you make sure you are taking care of all the financial matters that are within your control. I am thrilled if you are ready to make this shift. I hope your partner is just as thrilled. But I ask you to be patient and respectful in how you convey this change to your partner. You are pulling up a chair to join your partner at the table, not to take over. You want to be working together, side by side, building your financial security. Here's how you both can navigate your way to a healthy financial relationship. Create an accusation-free zone. Please approach this as a collaborative endeavor. You are not putting your spouse or partner to the test or questioning his or her choices. This is your partner, your lover, your life mate. Respect that bond. If you do find that some decisions that have been made run counter to the advice in the financial empowerment plan, talk it through. No accusations. Others deserve the no shame, no blame treatment as much as you do. I hope your spouse or partner is a financial whiz and made all the right moves for your family. But quite often, I see women mistake enthusiasm for expertise. If there are some mistakes in your plan, no worries. The point is that you are now a team that can make the necessary financial adjustments. Now, if you are years into a relationship with someone who actually likes the old-fashioned dynamic of being in total control of the money, you obviously want to be sensitive to that. Take the time to explain that although you are becoming involved with the finances, it is not about your spouse or partner giving up power or you questioning your partner's abilities. It is about your need to be knowledgeable and involved, to share the responsibility for your collective financial future. Agree that who earns what is irrelevant. When our world seems to increasingly, depressingly equate money with power, I realize it may be a challenge to not let money rule in your household. But I am convinced it's just a natural, misplaced habit that you and your partner can overcome. The bottom line is that all money decisions are to be collaborative. The primary breadwinner has no more say or sway over a decision. This is especially important for non-working spouses to embrace. Actually, it is important for every woman to embrace. If you are not earning an income, or you earn a fraction of your spouse's income, you must not equate that with being powerless. In a healthy, thriving, loving relationship, a paycheck does not assign power. Any woman who does not embrace this is putting herself seriously on sale. Do you know how often stay-at-home spouses tell me they don't know how to ask their partner for money to buy something the household needs, or, God forbid, something for themselves? Curiously, they tend to be responsible for the monthly bill paying, but not the family's long-term investment strategy. The thankless job is theirs, and when there isn't enough money to cover the monthly expenses, they are the ones made to feel guilty. Often the problem is that there simply isn't enough money coming in to cover all the bills, not that the stay-at-home mom isn't financially responsible. But women put up with this dynamic. It's my guess that they have an underlying sense of guilt or gratitude that their spouse is the one working while they get to remain at home. I want every stay-at-home mother today, and those of you who think you may go this route someday, to listen up and listen good. The job of the stay-at-home parent is equal to the job of the breadwinner. Please listen to that again. The job of the stay-at-home parent is equal to the job of the breadwinner. Your job is as important, as vital, and as necessary as that of the spouse who earns a paycheck. That is just as true for any woman who is not working outside the house, regardless of whether she is raising kids. Money is never to be a power tool wielded by the breadwinner. No spouse should ever need to ask the other for money or have to ask permission to spend a dime. That is wrong, wrong, wrong. Who earns the money is not the issue. The money that is earned is both of yours. Period. This spirit is just as important in households where the wife is the main breadwinner, an increasingly common dynamic in many households. Now, what I've seen happen time and again in this dynamic is that the wife tends to disown her power and downplay her role as breadwinner. She doesn't talk about it. She backs away from any acknowledgement of it because she doesn't want her husband to feel bad or less than. In fact, this kind of behavior enables the man to create a dysfunctional relationship of his own with money. Many times,